This is The Conversation, a podcast where we look at the contemporary art world's behind the scenes and between the lines by talking to people about what's going on. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. This is episode 222 with Hane Coe. She is a Brooklyn-based artist, and Hane is spelled H-E-I-N, last name Coe, K-O-H, in case you're looking it up. She has been in New York for many years and is just recently starting to have quite a bit of success showing in the galleries. And she is also the author of a social media post originally on Instagram that went viral featuring her breastfeeding her twins. It was coupled with a very thought-provoking caption about parenting, motherhood, and being an artist. And we talk about that. We talk about what happened in the wake of that viral post of hers and, you know, what it's like now being a parent, what it's like being an artist, and her recent success. And you can go to theconversationpod.com to check out images from her recent show at Marvin Gardens, as well as her studio in one of her older neighborhoods in Bed-Stuy. And there's a great shot of her twins hanging out beneath one of her flower sculptures. So go check those out. This is also a location where you can find past episodes, donate to the show, and so on. There's an episode index there now, and they do not link to all of the past 221 episodes of the show, but all you need to do is search the name of the person or people and The Conversation Art Podcast, and you will find that episode. On the back end today, I am going to get back into some Weiss links, including a axed out star on the Walk of Fame. Guess whose star it is? A couple of other ones as well. And I'm going to remind you about the Conversation Podcast Hotline, which I still want you to call. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a prompt to maybe amp you into doing it. Yeah, we're heading towards the very end of July. Hope you guys are enjoying your summers. All right, I think that's enough news for now. Let's jump into this conversation with Hane Coe. And as we begin the conversation, we had just spent a few minutes talking about the various neighborhoods around New York that she had lived in, and I asked her about what her thoughts were on gentrification and artists and gentrification. So that's where we begin. Stick around for the back end. Thank you guys so much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end.
Yeah, I'm like unfortunate that artists like inadvertently cause gentrification because we, right. You know, we move to these, you know, neighborhoods where rent is cheap, you know, where, you know, crime might be high, and you know, we're the pioneers, but then once like we start settling there, then yeah, that's what attracts businesses, and then all the people with money come in, and then you know, so gentrifies neighborhoods. But we, you know, we had pure intentions. I mean, we had no money in our 20s.
Sure.
And at that time, I was more into my music than the visual art. So, you know, we just needed practice space. Like, we wanted just to be able to go down a basement and play instruments, not worry about paying for a practice space and having a commute over there. So, at the time, that was really great for our band.
What was your band?
Oh, it was called Speedy Volva.
Speedy Volva.
It was a rival band. We played during college. It was my husband and my best friend and I, and then you know, my best friend, she was a year behind us in college, so actually, like, when we started playing shows in New York, she would still be in school, but I would try to book shows for us when she was on vacation, and then she would actually just, like, stay with us, like, she would stay with us, like, for a few days at a time, because she was still living at parents' time, and then, you know, practice down in the basement with us.
Yeah. And what was your music? What was your sound?
I would say, Riot Girl, like punk, pop, mm-hmm, very mm-hmm. 90s, mm-hmm. like, you know, Bikini Gill,
right.
Brown Beale, bands like that.
Right, Peter right.
Kenny, like, you know, those were the bands that we were into at the time.
Sure. And what kind of venues did you guys play in?
Well, the first, like, show we got was at this venue, Coney Island High. Do you remember Coney Island High? Or
I never think I made it, but I definitely heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it shut down, I don't know, maybe a decade ago or so, but it had been around for a long, it was like the premier punk venue. So it was really awesome to get the show there. And I just sent demo tapes, like homemade demo tapes, to a bunch of venues. And they gave a call and said, hey, we want to book you for a show.
Right.
So we played there. And then we played at other venues. Oh, Brownies was a really good venue.
I went to Brownies.
I saw a lot
of
good bands there.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I guess it's hard in some ways transitioning from, I mean, it's natural, and I think a number of artists do it, transitioning from music to from being in a band to, you know, being an artist. I would imagine that one of the biggest challenges is that it's such a delayed gratification, you know, compared to playing a live show. You know?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a willing transition. In college, I was into both art and music, and I took both seriously, but then I think once I graduated from college, I realized, like, you know, for me, when it comes to my personality type, like, I'd rather be alone most of the time. It's just so much easier to be alone than to collaborate with other people. And while I had a great chemistry in a band, the coordinating is tough. Like, just, like, managing, coordinating, and, you know, and then, like, having to play shows. I mean, I love, like, playing shows, but then I didn't really want to tour. You know, that's so exhausting. And I didn't see myself being a musician as I got older. But I could see myself, like, being an artist, you know, and just like working in my studio, like, as an old lady. If I thought, I don't see myself as a musician, like, way in the future. So, so I just naturally chose what I feel more comfortable with. Although, you know, I guess I wouldn't say I miss performing, but like, when I do have opportunities to perform, just, I don't know, doing like karaoke, something, like, I do love it. Like, I love singing and performing and the high of playing shows, but I find the lifestyle difficult to keep up with. I mean, I have some friends that I play with when I was younger who are still doing it now, and I think it's amazing that they stuck with it. And they have that personality type to keep up with it. They thrive on that kind of energy.
Yeah. So let's talk about this post that you made a couple of years ago, which I know you've talked about a lot, but we need to talk about it here. So. This was
it's been a while.
It was on Instagram that you first posted, is that right?
Yeah. I posted Instagram, and then I shared it to Facebook as well.
Right. Do you want to read it? Should we just take some excerpts from it? What would you think would be best? I mean, I know you've heard it a ton of times, but do you want me to read it?
Yeah. You can read it.
Okay.
Do you have it?
Yeah, I have it right. I have it right in front of me. Yeah. So.
Okay.
So #TBT51915. But you posted this in August of 2016. When my twins were 5 weeks old, and despite the sleep deprivation and frequent every 2 to 3 hours, 24/7, 45 minutes at a time breastfeeding, I was still getting shit done. #MarinaAbramovic thinks children hold women back in the art world, but as @Dubs19 put so aptly, fuck that. All Marina knows is her own experience, and it may be true for her, but that is not everyone's experience nor truth. Becoming a mom of twins, no less, has personally helped me become a better artist. I learned to be extremely efficient with my time, prioritize what's important, and let go of the rest, and multitask like a champ. I learned to function, even if barely, on very little sleep. And out of the chaos, insanity, and even torture at times, a flood of new emotions entered into my work, becoming more interesting and layered as a result. I'm also not saying that artist parents are better artists than non-parent artists, or that choosing not to be a parent will deny you access to these learning experiences. What I am saying is that parenting is like any other challenge in life, the biggest fucking challenge in my own life thus far. And if you embrace it and figure out creative solutions, you can emerge a better person. It's important to think about the ways in which these challenges can help you move forward rather than hold you back. Photo credit, Jim Horowitz. And you want to just describe the image for us?
It's an image of me breastfeeding my twins on a double breastfeeding pillow while I'm typing on a laptop.
Yep. Exactly. So that post that you made went viral, and I just did a search just before we got on. Hainco viral photo is what I searched. And if you scroll down about 10 or 12, the bottom of the first page, you get a Fox News article. So that gives you an idea of how viral it went. But so all that to set up, I mean, we could obviously deconstruct, you know, the meaning of that forever. But I just want to start by asking you, what it was like having that post go viral, and then, you know, what, you know, sort of how that played out for you.
Yeah, no, I'm actually glad you asked, because I feel like, yeah, I've talked about the photo so much because, yeah, I mean, everyone wanted interviews, everyone wanted to talk about it, but I never really got to talk about the aftermath of how it affected me. And it was insane, because I was not expecting it at all. I mean, if anything, I thought, oh, maybe like some people will like this. I mean, I really just meant it for my own community, like my friends and other people who follow me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, it's got like thousands and thousands of likes. And then, yeah, all the interviews were like pouring in. And I mean, I was on local Brooklyn TV, but then I was even on TV in New Zealand. And I was in Time magazine, all these women's magazines, like Glamour, Cosmo,
yeah,
the New York Times. And then, yeah, I don't know if you say, if you Google me and look under news, there are articles about me in like every single language, like some of which I don't even recognize.
Wow. Yeah.
It was really overwhelming. I mean, I felt like a celebrity for about a month. I thought, oh my God, I would never want to be a celebrity. Because
Sorry to interrupt. Just tell me about that. That's a really interesting sentiment. What are the cons that you alluded to, but pros as well, if any, that you can think of?
Yeah, I mean, it was nice that most people were so supportive. I mean, mm-hmm, I felt like I really spoke for a lot of women artists. Just stood up for us. But there was a lot of criticism as well. Oh my God, if you just get caught up reading about yourself, there's just so many trolls that have nothing better to do and criticize me for not, you know, like being emotionless and like not taking care of my kids and how horrible it was that I wasn't paying attention to them. You know, then they judge us from like one photo.
Right.
I mean, some people even like made like racist comments. Like someone like wrote that I was a pancake face, or how Asians are robotic anyway. Really, like, this horrible stuff. But
yeah.
It was stupid, you know? I mean, after a while, I realized, okay, I can't try to read all these stupid comments that people write.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the scrutiny was really hard for me at the time, you know? I mean, I went from feeling like I was, like, relatively obscure to, then, you know, just, like, seeing my picture, like, everywhere. So that was really weird, and especially trying to keep up with all the interview requests, because people will contact me and they want an interview but say, oh, can you talk by the end of today? And I felt I should try to oblige your request. I thought, well, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I should try to ride this train for positive reasons, because I'm trying to spread this positive message. I couldn't sleep for a while. I already have problems with insomnia, but I just remember during that period, like, I really couldn't sleep because the attention was freaking me out.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds intense. But I guess in retrospect, you feel like you were, you know, as you said, you were riding this thing, you know, you were,
mm-hmm,
you were, part of it was just, I'm just going to ride this thing kind of emotionally, but also clearly, as you said, you're getting, you know, taking the opportunity to get the message out.
Yeah, definitely. And that felt really good, because I felt like it was a conversation that was really needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially being a female artist, like it's something that we feel very self-conscious about. I mean, it's something that I've talked about with my friends and other artists, and, you know, especially now I'm at an age where, you know, I have two kids, a lot of my friends have kids, but when we were going through that transition, the question was, well, you know, just even little things like, oh, like, you know, do you let people know on Facebook that you're pregnant? Are you going to be taken less seriously as an artist? Like, this is stuff that we would talk about. Or you know, after the kids are born, oh, do you post your kids on Facebook? Oh, I don't think I should. Or I don't tell people I have kids during studio visits. And I was just like sick of that culture. Just like being so, you know, anti-kids. But I did personally worry about what was going to happen to my career. What was going to happen to, my work after having kids. You know, and then I didn't know. I left things flexible in mind. I thought, well, once I have kids, I'll just see what happens. Like, I thought, who knows? Maybe I won't be as connected to my work. I don't know. But mm-hmm, I found that after I had kids, I felt even more of an urgency to make my work. I mean, there was almost a desperation, because
right,
I didn't want to get swallowed up in motherhood. And I didn't want to lose, but, you know, the part of me, you know, my identity as an artist.
Right.
So I felt like very desperate. I mean, in the beginning, I was insane because I would try to work like while they were napping or middle of the night, or, you know, I couldn't get to my studio for a while. So I did drawings instead, even though I don't really draw, but I thought, oh, I'll make these drawings. And they're very personal. They just helped me experience the process of motherhood. And I thought maybe they were kind of corny, but I thought, I just want to let people know I'm making work. And I don't even care if people like these drawings. It's, you know, they're for me.
Yeah.
And I would just post them on Instagram because I want to let people know I was making work. And surprisingly, like, I got a good response to them. And then people asked me if they could show them. People asked me if they could buy them. And, you know, slowly I got back in the studio again. And now, you know, my kids are so interwoven into my work. You know, they influence and inspire me so much. And I know that, like, some people want to keep that area of their lives, like, separate from their studio work. But, I like having it all meld together. And my work, even like before recently, has always been pretty autobiographical. You know, it just feels natural to me to make work about my life, and that's how I process my life experiences.
Mm-hmm. Was there a point after your kids went through the baby stage that where you could bring them to the studio?
I brought them to the studio early on when they were just asleep, because newborns like take naps all the time.
Sure.
So I would count on their afternoon nap, you know, to work a little bit in the studio. And since I live close by and my studio has an elevator, they would fall asleep. And then I'd wheel them to my studio. I think, okay, hopefully I have like an hour and a half, 2 hours to work. Once in a while, when I wake up, and I'd be like, damn it, I need to work. And then I would just wheel them out and just like walk around a block counting, yeah, trying to get them to sleep again, which works sometimes, but not all the time.
It's interesting thing. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, before we get too far away from it, picturing you working furiously, you know, and then one of your twins waking up, and then it's like from a non-parent perspective, it seems like the only difference is working in the studio is that instead of being the decider of when your breaks are, your kids are deciding when your breaks are. So that's the only adjustment you have to make.
That's true. And the break is not a break.
Right.
Like,
that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. But wait a second. So that's an interesting point. So when you had that non-break with your kids, let's just say, you know, you needed to give them a feeding, and then you were done and they went back to sleep and then you went back to work, were you maybe, as opposed to being slightly more energized if you had just taken a break, were you more depleted when you went back to work?
I was depleted all the time.
Right.
It was so exhausting. It still is. I think things are definitely getting easier, but you know, there are new challenges with each day. My twins are three now. They just turned three in April, and now, they're potty trained and they can be themselves, but now, like, the new challenge is all the psychological battle. I mean, they rebel against me all the time. I can't get them to listen to me half the time,
but
I definitely like the stage much better than when they were newborns. Because even though they just like slept most time, just like being woken up every 2 to 3 hours, that was really brutal for me. So
so
you're just tired all the time. You can't ever get like a good night's rest.
Yeah.
So there's no break. And there's no break now. I work in my studio during the week, and, you know, I'm with my kids early morning. I mean, they actually just started camp this week. So now, I we get up and I get them ready for camp, you know, breakfast. And, you know, so then I drop them off and then I pick them up in the day, and then we have early evening together. And then weekends are like sacred. Weekends are family time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll try to like squeeze in an opening here and there, but that's usually after my kids go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But weekends are exhausting. And basically, as a parent, you have no doubt. I mean, it's fun having kids, but they drive you crazy too. And they,
sure,
you know, my kids wake up at 6:30 in the morning, like every single day.
Yep.
Every single day.
Sure. That's kids for you.
So, yeah, and they have so much energy. Like, right, you have to like figure out how to entertain them for so long.
Right.
At least this day they still take naps, so they take a nap from 1 until 3 or so.
Mm.
Although I know, like, you know, they're probably gonna grow out of that very soon. I mean, like any day now. But But now, like, I used to try to always work during naps and catch up on stuff. But I'm trying to take better care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So now weekends when they nap, I nap. Mm. And that's the only time, like, I can sleep well. Like, I just fall into, like, a deep sleep while they're napping, and it's, like, for 2 hours. But I feel like that sustains me for the rest of the week because I don't really sleep well during the week.
Right. It's probably a little early to tell at this point, but how have they taken so far to working on their own little art projects while you're working? Is that possible?
Oh, I mean, they've actually been in art class. They've been in art class, like, since they're 6 months old. But yeah, they don't, like, they don't come to the studio with me anymore. They haven't since they were really young. Because, yeah, whenever I try to bring them to the studio, this is what happened last time. Because my babysitter canceled me, and then my artwork was getting picked up by a gallery. So I thought, okay, I got to bring the kids to the studio. They come to my studio, and they find a bag of rhinestones. They start throwing the rhinestones all over my studio, saying, "Mommy, we're throwing a party for you." And just finding any random thing.
Right.
They took a bunch of wire and, like, wrapped it around my sculpture. And it's like, before I can even stop them, like, they're so fast. Like, they've already done, like, all this damage and made a big mess.
Right.
They're really hyper.
Yeah,
they're animals, right? Toddlers are animals.
Sure. Absolutely. So you just had this show that just ended last month, and I presume they went to it at some point. What are your kids at 3 years old think of your work?
Oh, they love it. It's so rewarding to bring them to my shows, and they don't talk about it. They talk about it a little bit, but they don't talk about it as much as they take in the energy. Mm. So the space, also because there's, like, space to, like, run around. Mm-hmm. I think they're more interested in that, and they kind of feed off the energy of my sculptures. So, yeah, so they were excited to see everything, and they kept running around. They kept asking if they could touch the art. They kept telling you can't touch art, but then sometimes I let them touch a little bit. They did ask if they could sit on one of my sculptures, this big ice cream cone. So I let them sit on it.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly interested in this, like raised area of the floor where there's, like, a door to the basement. So they actually stood on that, and, you know, because we were with their grandparents and my husband, and then also Anthony Myler, who runs the gallery, they like having an audience. So they stood up on what they saw the stage, and they kept singing and dancing. So that was how they experienced my show. But it's funny the things they remember now, because afterwards we were talking about my show, and then one of them said, "Yeah, the crying flowers, the cherries, and the watermelons, and the ice cream cone." And she just named everything in the show. I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe you remember that now.
Yeah, that's nice.
One of them mentioned my art recently because she said, "Oh, the crying flowers and the cherries." I'm like, "Oh, wow." I'm like, "You remember Mommy's art?" I said, "Do you think Mommy's art is the best?" And she goes, "No." But
ouch. I was just about to ask you if it was nice having those, little kid reminders of, you know, of who you are and what you're doing, but it sounds like it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, but overall, I think I know they love my art, and I feel like, I mean, they've just grown up with it, so for them, it's just there. It's just a part of their lives. And
sure,
I mean, and when I see my art, I just see it as extensions of them. It's all kind of one of the same.
Speaking of which, you know, so this show that you had in your work generally these days does have certain what adjective would you like to use? I was going to say childlike elements to it, which is, I know, a very unsophisticated way of addressing it, but I just am trying to set it up in terms of, as you were talking about earlier, you know, we were talking about the post and your philosophy around motherhood and everything being interwoven with your work, you know, how much having kids directly impacted this body of work, say?
Yeah, well, the work I was making before I had kids was darker and more sexual and also more monochromatic. I was making abstract sculptures that reference the body. And my work now references the body, but that body of work more directly referenced the body. And then I found that after having kids, now I just want to put so much color into my work. And I started working with metallic spandex right after they were born. So it's just been, you know, 3 years now. A lot of glitter and sequins, and a lot of the imagery comes from them and their stuff. because I read to them every night. So
yeah,
I'm really influenced by children's book illustrations now.
Mm.
I love like the simplification of form and how, especially like just seeing how they, take in images, like how they are able to just like translate them. I think it's fascinating. Like for a while, when they were about 1.5, they were really fascinated by the sun and the moon. And now, like any like yellow circle is the sun, or any like white circle is the moon. And mm-hmm. I find that so fascinating to see how their visual vocabulary is developing. So I actually made a piece called Sun and Moon, and I named it Sun and Moon for Ami and Oni, my twins' names or the nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's the books, and then also like their clothes. I really didn't want to I didn't want them to dress too girly when I was young. So I just don't like how, we assign like genders to kids, and girls, wear pink and boys wear blue. So, for my baby shower, like I told my friends to write on the invite, like, please, don't give me anything pink.
Right.
So they actually dressed like boys for a while, and they also dressed pretty like, I think I often just dressed them in like black and gray stripes and jeans when they were little babies. But I don't know, something broke, and eventually I got so into the girly stuff because it is really freaking cute. So now they wear tutus, they wear pink dresses. I got into all the clothes with rainbows and stars and uh-huh. glitter, and they love it too. They're
right.
They're going through a princess phase now, which I was very anti-princess too, but finally I gave in. And they asked me one day if I would buy them princess dresses. I'm like, oh, I don't know. But then, I came home, like, okay, I'm going to buy them princess dresses. It'll make them happy. So went to this, like, secondhand children's store and found two perfect princess fairy dresses. And they were so happy. And, like, they're these dresses, like, covered in tulle with, like, flowers and glitter.
Yeah.
So inevitably, all this stuff has just entered my work because I'm surrounded by so much cuteness every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like it's a real privilege because not everyone is, but because I have these kids and they're so freaking cute and their stuff is so cute, it totally softened me and I'm into it.
Yeah,
but at the same time, at work is not just cute. I mean, there is this level of like perversion to it or something that's kind of scary. Because I can't let things get too cute. That's just not who I am.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking that for a second about your work, but just in terms of your kids alone, you describe sort of basically giving in and, giving into the soft side, essentially.
Yeah. And it feels good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like they've helped me tap into parts of myself that I've lost touch with. I feel like now I'm more in touch with my inner child through them.
Mm, right. I want to ask you about what your life has been like in terms of you as an earner, leading up to having kids, during having kids, and up to now. So I know that's kind of a very general way of putting it, but maybe using the sort of model of, your places of your homes, throughout New York, maybe
mm-hmm.
maybe you could sort of do a little bit of a roundup that way as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so I've had a million jobs. When I first moved to New York, I was definitely a risk taker, and my mm-hmm. husband and I decided to move to New York. I didn't even have a job lined up. I thought, I'll find something. Well, a friend of mine who had graduated a year before, he got work through a temp agency. He actually got a good job. He got a job as an art handler as a good guy. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll do something like that. So I just decided I would temp until I figured out what I wanted to do, because I didn't even know what I wanted to do at the time. I mean, my plan at the time was to take some time off and eventually apply to grad school for psychology. I thought I would do that. So I wasn't even sure if I was going to pursue art. So, I just went to a bunch of temp agencies, and then I ended up working in fashion, just doing fashion production. Not really interesting work, but it paid the bills. And one of the jobs I was at, I was doing production work for Limited. They liked me, and they wanted to hire me full-time. And, it's a career path I could have taken.
How did you get into fashion production sort of almost accidentally?
Just through the temp agencies. Yeah, I mean, they were temp employment agency, so I just gave them my resume, and so sometimes a lot of these companies like would look for temporary help, or they would look for a lot of these jobs were called temp to perm, so they would just like try someone out for a position that was open. If they liked the person, then they would hire them full-time.
What kind of skills did you have though that made you such a desirable candidate?
Well, I went to Ivy League school. I went to Dartmouth.
Right.
And, well, I wouldn't say I was the best student. I was more interested in making my art than in my grades. But, mm-hmm. you know, the Dartmouth name went pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
And, I interviewed well. Specifically, I used Excel. So I actually did a lot of, like, spreadsheets for the fashion companies.
Oh, okay. So yeah. it was pretty administrative stuff, in other words.
Yeah. It was all computer work. And, since I was a studio art and psychology major, so I actually did a lot of spreadsheets for my psych classes, like for the labs that I took.
Funny.
It's like something I learned, like, my last year of school. I actually ended up getting a job in the fashion industry. So
right.
I would make all these spreadsheets about, like, clothing lines.
Right. Got it. So what happened after fashion?
And then they wanted to hire me, but I just thought, oh, this is not for me. Because I thought, I don't want to be an office drone, and it's just not creative enough. And I kept thinking I'll be creative, but I didn't know if I wanted to do art. I was really, like, questioning if I want to be an artist or how do you make it as an artist in New York? Like, how do you support yourself and find time to work? My husband was actually deferring med school, but he had some experience in graphic design. Mostly just making band posters during college. But he got lucky and he found a job at a startup software company, just doing like a little bit of everything. But he's just one of those guys who knows how to do a lot of things. So his boss liked that after him. And he also liked the fact that he was Dartmouth. So he hired him and just, figured he would find some way to employ him. So then, and then I realized, like, this was during 99, during the internet boom, and, web design, graphic design, like, were paying really well. A lot of people were, like, freelancing. So I thought, and that's something that I didn't really know very well. So I decided that I wanted to, like, learn computer programs. Like, I wanted to learn web design. I wanted to learn Photoshop and Illustrator and then eventually freelance so I don't have to work as many hours and I could eventually pursue my art. So that was my long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, after I went to work at the Limited, I would go to the office that my husband worked at, which is actually down the street in Soho. So I would go there, and his boss was, like, really laid back, just starting a new company, and he would let me use the computers there, and I would just, like, teach myself all these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually he just hired me. He asked me, well, do you want to work here full time? So I said, sure. So he took me on as a web designer, and I had barely any experience, but I learned quickly. So since he wasn't interested in the web design aspect of his company more, I handled all of his clients. So one of my big clients was the Jewish Museum. Like, I did all their web design for a year.
Wow.
Actually longer than that, because after a year of that, I decided that, after working there for a year, I just started getting back into painting again. And I felt like it was just too much, like working there and then coming home painting. And then I finally knew that being an artist is what I want to do with my life, and I want to eventually apply to grad school. I decided I would just quit. And again, I decided to quit without a job lined up. I thought, I'll figure something out, but I just don't want to, work 9 to 5. I mean, actually, hours, like, were a little longer. And I thought, I'll just find something. I'll, like, freelance or find something creative. I just was willing to take the risk and, like, let things just fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
So I told my boss I was leaving. And I decided I would ask him, can I take the Jewish Museum with me? Because, they were a client that was paying a lot. And I figured if I at least had that one client, I could support myself, at least mostly support myself with that one client. And then he said, well, why don't you just take all the web design clients? Because, like I said, he didn't care about that aspect of his business anymore. So they were just a few, but I was able to just support myself, like, doing freelance web design for, like a handful of clients, like five or less, for the next 3 years. Until I went to grad school.
That sounds
really great.
That sounds incredibly lucky to me.
Yeah. And also web design was paying better back then because of the internet boom.
And not
that many people knew how to do it. So then I went to grad school and I was still like keeping up a little bit with the web design, but I realized just getting immersed in the grad school environment, I thought, I can't keep up with this business and make my art. And my heart wasn't in it.
Mm-hmm.
It can just wear on you, just like making work for clients. And it's all about fulfilling the request and then get really nitpicky.
Yeah.
And I decided I wanted to teach anyway. That was my plan. So I just like let go of the business. And then after I graduated and I moved to Philly, that's when I started pursuing teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So my first teaching job was actually at an after-school program in North Philly, underprivileged neighborhood. And it didn't pay very well, but see, this was like the harsh reality. Like, I went to Yale, but I didn't have any teaching experience. And the only job I could find was this, like, after-school program for a few hours, like, you know, teaching these underprivileged kids. But mm-hmm. And it wasn't even art. It was a little bit of everything, or it was a pretty flexible program.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the job, though. Like, my kids were, like, really great. But I did want to eventually teach art and, you know, maybe eventually teach college as well. So I, after that teaching job, like, I had a whole bunch of teaching jobs. Then I taught for this, like, kids art program, like another after-school art program called the Mural Arts Program, like focused on painting murals, but they did other kinds of art as well. And then when I moved to New York, there were definitely more opportunities. There just weren't as many in Philly. So I taught an art and literacy program for kids. I also taught at the 92nd Street Y, I taught after-school classes for kids there. I taught a drawing class at Tyler, so I commuted back to Philly to teach this drawing class for a semester. I also taught art to cancer patients through a nonprofit, and what else? I worked as an artist assistant. I also spent a year at Dartmouth as a visiting professor. That was my last teaching job.
Well, so let me ask you. Let me jump in, because most of those jobs fit under the same umbrella or category of working at some kind of nonprofit, you know, that involves kids.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got that drawing teaching job at Tyler. So you got an art school teaching job, which is a whole different thing. So that kind of seems like the open door to, you know, to that line of teaching. So how did you get that job?
That I got through this artist, Donna Nelson. I met her. We had a mutual friend. One of her friends, Rochelle Feinstein, was one of the professors at Yale. So one of my friends from grad school was talking to Rochelle and said, oh, hey, move to Philly. And Rochelle said, oh, like, you know, she should get in touch with my friend Donna Nelson. And so I was looking for work. So, you know, she gave me her email. So I emailed her and said, hey, I was just wondering, you know, if you need any help. So I ended up just like working for Donna just a couple of times, just mm-hmm. like doing freelance studio work. I just stretched canvases for her. I mean, one time I stretched canvases, another time I helped her transfer paintings to New York. And I also like helped feed her cat.
Mm-hmm.
And she checked out my work. So eventually, yeah, it was, I think it was right after we decided we were in New York. Oh, we knew we were in New York, but yeah, we were just about to move to New York. Like she said, well, you know, I talked to Tyler about getting a teaching job and, they like your work and they were wondering if, you know, you want to teach this drawing class. I thought, oh, wow, this is awesome. But time is so bad because now I'm moving to New York, but of course I took it. And, you know, what's interesting is that, like, I thought I would love teaching college and, you know, wasn't like what it was like cut out to be. You know, I actually found that at the time I was doing that and I was teaching kids, but like I found teaching kids, especially teaching like underprivileged youth, just so much more fulfilling.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. It was, like, it's something about it. I just felt like, I guess maybe it was like the psychologist part of me, or, you know, I was also like interested in like social work. You know, I felt like it just had more meaning to me at the time. And,
sure.
And I mean, surprisingly, a lot of the you know, kids teaching jobs were even like paying better than the adjunct teaching
right,
jobs in
Philly. Right.
And it was such a long commute too. So
sure.
They asked me to return the following semester. But I said no. It was also, they could only offer me digital drawing, and I didn't feel like I could be a strong digital drawing teacher. So after that, I really didn't pursue any college teaching jobs for a while. I was pretty happy, teaching kids. And also I really liked my job teaching lots of cancer patients.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until 2013 when, you know, Dartmouth, my alma mater, asked me if I would, one of my professors from undergrad, she was taking sabbatical. So she asked me, like, can you take over my classes, you know, for a couple of semesters? So, not having children, I was able to do it. And that, you know, actually coming back to it a second time, I really liked it. And I think also because it was a school I had gone to, and, also, I was teaching sculpture, which I had never taught before. And I realized, I do love teaching sculpture so much more than drawing. When I'm with drawing, you have to kind of go through all the basics, like the figure, landscape. But then with sculpture, you know, even if you're teaching basic sculpture, I feel like kids, like, they get, like, or I shouldn't say kids, students, like, they have interesting results, like, right away. And you don't have to, like, go through, like, all the basics. I mean, you know, depending on how much freedom you have at school. I had a ton of freedom at Dartmouth. So that was really fun for me.
How was it, though, that you got the sculpture job, teaching job, when you weren't really an experienced sculptor or sculpture teacher, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, I mean, just it was through connections. I mean, just like, you know, so much in life is like through connections. And
yeah,
my professor, Brenda Guerin, she was one of my sculpture teachers, you know, back at Dartmouth. I mean, I was a painting major, but I took a sculpture 2 class with her, and I also took senior seminar with her, and we had just stayed in touch over the years, and she knew I was making sculptures. I had just started making sculptures in 2011, so, you know, by the time she got from the job, like, only for 2 or 3 years, and she wanted me to cover her classes. She just, you know, she trusted me, and,
right,
you know, for that, like, yeah, I feel really grateful.
Yeah. So what
and,
are you...
And I even asked her. I told her, like, yeah. I said, I don't know. I'm not a strong woodworker. I don't even know how to use plaster. I don't know how to weld. And, you know, I do these are things that, like, being taught to her. She said, oh, you know, don't worry about it. You can do whatever you want.
Nice. So let's just speed up to now. What are you doing these days in addition to making your work?
So now I'm just making my work and taking care of my kids.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not working a job right now.
Right. That's nice, right?
Yeah, I'm definitely in a very privileged position.
Yeah. And how's your work going in terms of supporting you?
Better. I mean, I'm actually starting to sell more regularly now, just like recently.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I think things are on the upswing.
Yeah,
getting like a lot more shows and more attention to my work. I mean, I feel like my recent solo show really opened up a lot of doors for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that feels really great.
What was it, do you think, that was the turning point? Can you pinpoint it?
Well, I think my show was, but even before then, I mean, my career has just been a slow build. So I've been just gaining momentum for a long time. And I think it's important for people to hear this too, because I think a lot of people, like, you know, when they see other people's careers or the stories you hear about, or people, like, having success, like, right out of grad school. But it doesn't happen that way for a lot of people, for most people. It's been a while since I graduated from grad school. I graduated in 2004, and I feel like I'm just emerging now. But, I stuck with it. You know, I think that's really important. Because a lot of people do give up or lose faith in their work. But, you know, I think as long as you maintain, like, a connection to work, I've always loved making work. I mean, whether I'm making money or not, or, you know, receiving attention or not. Like, I just always love making work. The only thing that's changed now is, like, I still love making work, but it's like other people are liking it too.
Yeah, but you did say that it's been a gradual build, which is often the case, you know, for people who don't just, you know, rocket out into the stratosphere right out of grad school. But it sounds like you essentially said this, but I just want to make sure I understand right. This recent show that you just had kind of was a breaking point in terms of opening the doors and also sort of beginning to attract a steady collector stream.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I was just really ripe for solo. This was my first solo show in New York, and the very first solo show I had was just a year ago in Baltimore. So I hadn't even had a solo show until last year. And then finally, now 14 years out of grad school, I had my first solo show in New York. So in that sense, yeah, I feel like the momentum is building.
Yeah.
I have a show. I worked really hard on it. It was great. And I feel like, especially Instagram, gives artists like so much exposure. So a lot of people who didn't even see the show saw on Instagram.
Right. Did you get it approached by any collectors through Instagram?
Yeah, I did. Collectors and other important art people. I mean, I'm in this group show at Paul Kasman right now, you know, curated by Yvonne Force Villarreal. And I know, like, she wrote, like, a curator for Paul Kasman, like, tagged her on, like, a post of one of my shows, and she wrote it. Oh, I was planning to go see this. And I don't think she ever made it, but she emailed me in the gallery and asked if I would be in the show. So that was entirely through Instagram, like, not having seen my work in person.
Right. That's awesome.
And I've known who she is, like, for a long time. I mean, I actually met her, like, a decade ago, and, you know, and it feels great for her, you know, to be asked to be in the show.
she's the curator for this show, but also for the gallery, or just clarify for me.
Oh no, she's like an outside curator. She was the founder of the Art Production Fund. They did like public art projects, but now she has a new company called Culture Core. Mm-hmm. But a curator for Paul Kasman or Danny Moynihan. I think he just curates for them sometimes. Like he was the one who like told her about work, but turned out she knew about it anyway. And he also approached her about curating the show at Paul Kasman.
Right. How's that show going?
Great. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, a lot of people have been seeing it and the response has been good.
Because this gallery, and I guess I asked that because Paul Kasman is a pretty, visible gallery, and this show that you had was at Marvin Gardens, correct? Which mm-hmm. I presume, I'm not in New York, so, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's doing well, but doesn't have a very high profile, correct?
Right, yeah, it's an artist-run space. It's a very well-respected artist-run space.
Right.
But, it's way out in Ridgewood. A lot of artists know about it, but it's not an established gallery like Paul
right.
Kasman.
Right, got it. Well, I think we've covered it. Do you feel like there's anything we left out?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I'm going to let you get back to work. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much again to Hayne for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. If you have any comments, questions, or otherwise about our conversation, I welcome you to shoot an email to theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, or better yet, record a message on the Conversation Podcast hotline. That number is 424-256-6618. I will tell you more about the podcast hotline if you are not familiar later in this outro. For now, wanted to give you a heads up that I'm going to be talking about taking a pickaxe to Trump's star on the Walk of Fame from the Weiss Link and a couple of other Weiss Links as well. First, briefly, I just want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. That means you, the listener, are instrumental in supporting the show financially and otherwise. And when we do not have an advertisement on the episode, as with this one, your financial support is the only way that we can move forward. So your financial support is greatly appreciated. You can go to theconversationpod.com/support and donate to the show one of two ways, via PayPal or via Patreon, which is an ongoing subscription service where you can donate to the show for as little as $1 a month. And thank you to all of you who are continuing to support the show via Patreon with your monthly donations. If you happen to pledge to Patreon $5 or more a month, or a one-time donation of $30 or more via PayPal, I will add you to the special friends of the conversation list, which means you'll get updated on bonus episodes. You'll be sent all of the current 6 bonus episodes, and you will receive my undying love as well, of course. So thank you very much. You can also support the show by leaving a great review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, which is linked through theconversationpod.com. It helps other people find the show. 5-star reviews, very much appreciated. Thank you so much in advance for that. Of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can become a fan on Facebook as well. Thank you guys very much. And why don't I tell you more about the podcast hotline before we get to the Weiss Links. So just last episode, for the first time, I announced the Conversation Podcast Hotline, which is a way for you as a listener to become more involved in the show. The idea is that you leave your feedback, you ask questions, you leave anecdotes, stories, anything along those lines. And if it's of interest to the show, and I think to our listeners, I will start including them in the outro of this show. Again, that number is 424-256-6618. You can leave a message of any length. Might want to keep it to a couple minutes or less. And as a prompt for this particular episode, it's about the middle of summer. What is your summer agenda? Are you seeing more art or less? Are you working in the studio more or less? Are you traveling? So let us know what's going on with you this summer, and I will potentially share that on the next episode. If you are too shy to call in and leave a message, you're more than welcome to send an email to theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think that way or share your story that way. All right. Thank you in advance. So let's get to the Weisslings, shall we? The first one comes from alum of the podcast, Tim Schneider. He writes on ArtNet, I think we've officially reached a point in the art world where immersive installation has been reduced to meaning, quote, all four walls you're standing between have paintings on them, unquote. Next one is from an artist who I have quoted in the outro before, the wise, I believe, Berlin-based Yinka Schönebare. Yinka's Schönebare writes, the noise of the art market can be an obstacle to creativity. What do you think is the biggest difficulty to artists today? What's your life hack? The noise and distraction of the art market is the biggest obstacle to the creativity of young artists today. My life hack is never doing art full time. You must experience life too. Read, party, see films, dance, theater, or other people's art. Whatever else takes your fancy. That's from the Evening Standard UK, and I couldn't agree more. And finally today, we have this, which comes from the LA Times right here in Los Angeles. It's titled, Taking a Pickaxe to Trump's Star, Does LA's Creative Resistance Go Too Far? So I just found out about this. I saw a post on social media, but I didn't know what the reference was because it wasn't mentioned. I didn't even know Trump had a star on the Walk of Fame, but he did, and somebody axed it out. So it's a bunch of crumbled pavement in the place of where and metal where that star was. So here's the article's excerpt. Quote, I don't think we've got any Trump properties in LA, so people are taking their frustration out on the star, said the artist. I presume that's the artist who axed up the star, who asked to remain anonymous because many of his pieces veer into illegality. Quote, the star is a very visible symbol of his celebrity, an obvious place to attack in a way. This anti-Trump sentiment reached a new level Wednesday when the star was annihilated with a pickaxe by a vandal who quickly turned himself in to police. While it wasn't immediately clear what the 24-year-old man's motivations were, images of the gouged-out star swiftly spread across social media, taking on a meaning of its own, the latest political protest on the canvas that is the streets of Los Angeles, for better or worse. Quote, it's a very visceral visual statement that speaks a thousand words, unquote, said Rosa Loewinger, an LA-based art writer and conservator who has studied vandalism in public spaces. These are time-honored traditions of expression, she says. In Los Angeles, where the president's critics far outnumber his fans, Trump has been depicted in street art in a headlock by a luchador, naked or blindfolded and holding a dart with his hand guided by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Since the 2016 election, Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame has been subject to spit, kisses, dog feces, selfies, and urine. It's been sharpied, graffitied, walled in, and sledgehammered. The artist collective In Decline put a naked statue of Trump on Hollywood Boulevard during the election in what it said was a metaphor based on the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Emperor's New Clothes. The group has also vandalized Trump-owned hotels and golf courses in protesting the president and his policies. Quote, there's always a fine line between destruction and art, said a representative of In Decline, who asked to remain anonymous because many of the group's activities run afoul of the law. He said because graffiti artists and creative types are far more likely to be disdainful of Trump than to be supporters, his presidency has led to a spike in politically themed street art. Quote, we took a nice long nap during Obama, he said. Whether it's naked statue or taking a pickaxe to the sidewalk, you're going to see more of it for the next 2 years until he gets voted out, unquote. And again, that's from the LA Times. If you're too shy to call in to the podcast hotline, definitely feel free to send an email or leave a comment on the website. It would be much appreciated. And you can identify yourself as anonymous either by phone or email, and we won't mention your name if you prefer that. You can trust us, really. There are people that help make this show possible, and I briefly want to thank them. Big thanks to Andy Davis for producing this show, as well as Caleb Bissinger, Jennifer Luigis, and Megan Bickle. Thanks to all of them. All right, guys, that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for being here and for listening. Let us know what you think, one way or another, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.